This is it, folks. Sex and Sophia.
Finally.
So when the lecture committee asks me for an agenda of the lectures, they do so a few weeks in advance of the seminars. And I don't finish these thoughts that far in advance. So in a project like this, as I'm working along, trying to compose a talk one at a time, stuff happens. A chaos of thoughts and images are sort of fighting their way into some form. It involves some suffering, and I'm usually surprised by where some of the paths lead as I go. I selected the title Sex and Sophia for this session because it was a talk to follow lunch, and I wanted to titillate you out of postprandial naps. Or say something amusing, and I had no idea what it was going to be. This is the day after Valentine's Day, and I suspected I could arouse some lingering seasonal erotic energies and mix them up with the subject of Sophia. And it can be fun to play with Eros, except when you get terribly burnt. And of course, Eros is fire. However, on the path here, I unexpectedly met something darker. And Eros was entirely absent. It was not part of this shadow fact. The titles Sophia and Sex summoned another image, another sexual fact, and it demanded remembrance. It is sex absolutely devoid of Eros. And this is part of Sophia's story. It is sex as defilement, as usage, as submission. It is sex as hatred, as rage. It is murderous, destructive, and brutal sex. We call it rape. And it seems to be part of our animal nature. This human behavior is as old as history. It's one of many acts of war. Subjugation by defilement of women. And it is still part of many cultures, including our own. It is a fact of the psyche. And it retells itself in history of the living and the dead. Unfortunately, I know something about this human event. I meet its trauma more often than do most people. Part of my job as an ER doctor is seeing women who have been raped. They come first to the emergency room, or they're brought by the police first to the emergency room for me to interview and examine. And it is one of the most dreaded of my duties. And you know, often, there is scant physical evidence of injury. And yet, there has been injury. What does rape do to a soul? What powers rule the psyche of a man who does this to a woman? And what happens to his soul? Rape is not just an act of coercive intercourse. It is a psychological mutilation, a soul wound. Sophia, in the myth, confronts the powers that want to subjugate her, and they seek to do it by raping her. Now, we talked earlier about three levels, or as I called them, acts, in Sophia's myth. And there's this archetypal level. And here, I'm using a conceptual language when I say archetypal, Jung's supposedly scientific language. It's a story. The archetypal fact exists before beginnings. It is the beginning of beginnings. It is the background of conscious life, a thing we can only image by story. And in this story of Sophia, two realities are in relationship. Call them spirit and soul, call them soul and flesh, call them word and image. Logos and Sophia. Make up other terms, other conceptual language for the story, for the experience, if you wish. There is a relationship there, however one tries to express it, to name it. And then in this story of Sophia, there comes a second act, this multi-layered tale of how the relationship plays in the genesis of cosmos, of the coming to be of life. And here, archetypal images are more precise. They take personalities. The plot thickens. And a demiurge and his archons appear. Now, we're in Act 3 of this story. And in this act, humans are on the stage. And they're dealing with psychic realities and their own formed images, the complexes, the soul facts. Powers are present on the stage of human life. And the first pair of humans appearing on stage in the Gnostic myth are, of course, the primal human pair, Adam and Eve. And here let me just draw a distinction in this consciously reflected mythology, this Gnostic mythology. This is a third layer of the story. Whereas in traditional or canonical stories, this is really the beginning. In Gnostic mythology, there's the knowledge that other powers have been playing and evolving, emanating down into this act of life. So Adam and Eve. I read to you the story of Eve, taken from the Gnostic text On the Origin of the World. I read it just today as well. Again, I quote it. Sophia sent Zoe, life, her daughter, who is called Eve, as an instructor in order that she might raise up Adam. When Eve saw her companion, she exclaimed, "Adam, rise, rise up from the earth." And Adam rose up and opened his eye. And when he saw her, he said, "You will be called Mother of Living, because you are the one who gave me life." But what happens next in this Gnostic myth? You know, we considered in our last talk the demiurge. The demiurge is a chief of many minions. He has functionaries in his service. And Gnostics called these complexes archons, the authorities. And we all deal with our archons, with our inner authorities. And some of us are slaves of them. In fact, in some way, all of us encounter that slavery. In the story of Sophia, Sophia had sent Zoe, her daughter, life, who was also called Eve, to awaken Adam. But you will recall this first Adam was created, molded from clay by the archons of the demiurge and his agents. They molded his flesh in their image to serve them. Eve awakened Adam to his true potential nature. She awakened him into conscious life. Now the archons in the Gnostic myth hear that something's up. Something's happened to Adam. That he is now standing up. And he's talking with Eve. The Archons are displeased. This bitch, Sophia, this Eve, is messing with their domination. And they want to get this bitch. They want to show her who is boss. Let me read this ancient text. And I quote, "The authorities were told that their mottled body, Adam, was alive and had gotten up, and they were greatly troubled. They sent 7 messengers to see what had happened. They came to Adam, and when they saw Eve speaking with him, they said to each other, 'Who is this enlightened woman? Come, let's seize her and ejaculate our semen into her, that so she may be unclean and unable to ascend to her light, and her children will serve us.' Let's not tell Adam, because he's not one of us. Instead, let's put him to sleep and suggest to him in his sleep that Eve came from his rib, so that the woman may serve and he may rule over her. Since Eve was a heavenly power, she laughed at what they had in mind. She blinded their eyes and secretly left something that resembled her image with Adam. She entered the tree of knowledge and stayed there. The rulers chased her, and she revealed to them that she had entered the tree and had become a tree. The blind powers fell into great fear, and they ran away. Later, when they recovered their sight, they came to Adam. They saw a female like Eve with him, and they were troubled and thought that this was the true Eve. They acted rashly. They came to her, they seized her, and they ejaculated their semen upon her. The powers acted wickedly. They defiled her in ways natural and obscene. First, they defiled the seal of her voice, her mouth, which had said to them, 'What exists before you?' The authorities and their angels erred. They did not know. They defiled their own body and likeness in all these ways." End quote. What a powerful text. What's going on here? What's going on? Is this a psychology and a mythology? This is not theology. It's certainly not the story of Adam and Eve you've heard. And it's certainly not metaphysics. Give conscious reflection, psychological reflection to this myth. What is going on? What had Eve said? What had Eve said that aggravated the worldly powers the most? She asked them a frightening, perhaps even emasculating question. What exists before you? The Demiurge and his many agents are intent on raping Sophia, Zoe, Eve, life. It is their response to her power. They subjugate her by attempting to defile her. And then they construct a lie about her origins, saying she is just a piece of Adam's flesh, just a rib. Or maybe she's like some juice squeezed from his brain, a neurophysiological epiphenomenon of flesh. Sophia's story in this Gnostic mythology is actually multi-generational. Let me tell you the next chapter of the myth. And this is from another text that's also found at Nag Hammadi. You see, this Gnostic mythic outpouring was occurring in many geographical locations during this age of new visions, 2,000 years ago. Many human imaginations were writing chapters for this big red book, this new book. And this was a time when a new book was under authorship, remember. The one that survived we call the New Testament. These texts were forming at the same time. They were the book that did not survive. Except it did. It did survive. Here it is. And these authors, these imaginative voices, they wrote these things. They worked with similar motifs, but each chapter added used different images. The following reading is from a text known as the Reality of the Rulers, or the Hypostasis of the Archons, as it was once called. And it's a different text. It was written by different hands. It has a different provenance in its transmissions. It deals with this same story. In Gnostic imagination, Eve had a daughter who carried her light forward into history. Into history. She was Eve's fourth child, and her name was Noreia. The name Noreia is possibly associated to the Syriac word for light or fire, Nur. It also might be related to the Greek term for beautiful, Oreia. The fire, beauty, Noreia. Yeah, as you'll recall, things did not go particularly well for Adam and Eve's first two children, Cain and Abel. And Gnostic myths gave very little attention to the story of that fratricidal murder. That was not their story. In Gnostic myth, the most important story, their story, the story of their dead, their ancestry, begins with the next two children of Adam and Eve, a male and a female. The third child of Eve is called Seth, and the fourth was the daughter, Noreia. And these are the conscious children. They're the awake human race, the progenitors of the awakened ones. They are more children of their mother, more like Eve, like Zoe, like Sophia. Mythically, they became progenitors of Gnostic tradition, and they were the ancestors whose living words they felt still awakened human attention. So let me tell you Noreia's story. And I quote, Eve became pregnant again. This is her fourth child after Seth. Eve became pregnant again and gave birth to Noreia. Eve said, He has produced for me a virgin to help many generations. Noreia is the virgin whom the forces did not defile. Humanity began to multiply and develop. The rulers then plotted together and said, Come, let's cause a flood with our own hands and destroy all flesh, animal, and human. You've heard that story about Noah. What's going on here? You note that the rulers here want to destroy humanity because they are developing. They're freeing themselves. They're standing up. But the rulers decide they're going to save one fellow as their servant. So I continue with the reading. So the ruler of the forces said to Noah, "Make an ark of wood that will not rot, and hide it, and hide in it you and your children, and the animals, and the birds of the sky, large and small. Put it on Mount Seir. Noreah came to Noah and wanted to board the ark. He would not let her. When he would not let her, she breathed on the ark and made it burn up. So he built another ark. Why didn't Noah want to let Noreah on the ark?
She was too powerful.
She was subversive. Subversive to the rulers. I mean, the rulers were building this ark. They were going to wipe out all these people, animals and all, because they were developing. Noreah was this voice of a type of consciousness, and the rulers didn't want anything to do with it. Okay, so what does she do? Fire, beauty. Burns up his ark. And so he built another. I read on. After that scene, this continues. The rulers went to Noreah. And when I say rulers, remember, these are the minions of the Demiurge. The authorities. The rulers went to Noreah, for they planned to seduce her. Their leader said to her, "Your mother Eve came to us." But Noreah turned to them and said, "You are the rulers of darkness. Damn you. You did not have sex with my mother, but with one of your own ilk. For I am not from you. I am from the world above." The arrogant ruler turned with his might, and his expression was like a blazing fire. He was bold toward her and said, "You must serve us sexually, as your mother Eve did." But Noreah turned with the power of God and called in a loud voice to the Holy One, the God of all, "Help me with these unrighteous rulers and rescue me from their hands now." An angel came down from heaven and said to her, "Why are you calling to God? Why are you so bold toward the Holy Spirit?" Noreah said, "Who are you?" The unrighteous rulers had left her. They saw the angel come and they fled. The unrighteous rulers had left her. The angel said to Noreah, "I am Eleleth, understanding, the great angel who stands before the Holy Spirit. I have been sent to speak with you and rescue you from the hands of the lawless ones. And I shall teach you about your root." And now the voice in this text, and I'm reading directly from this text. Now the voice in this text changes, and Noreah herself speaks in the first person voice and tells what happens. I cannot describe the power of that angel. Its appearance is like fine gold, and its garment is like snow. My mouth simply cannot bear to speak of its power and the appearance of its face. The great angel, Eleleth, spoke to me and said, "I am understanding. I am one of the four luminaries who stands before the great invisible spirit. Do you think these rulers have power over you? None of them can overpower the root of truth. For on behalf of the root of truth, A figure has appeared in the last days, and these authorities will be restrained. These authorities cannot defile you or that generation, for your home is with incorruptibility, with the Virgin Spirit, who is superior to the authorities of chaos and their world. End quote. Sophia's story continues. Sophia's myth. What are the archons, the rulers, afraid of? What are they trying to defile? What do they wish to quiet? Feminine principle, what?
Dissension.
Dissension of, against them.
Consciousness, maybe.
Consciousness. Adam stands up. Eve helps him stand up. They want to destroy the human race because they're progressing.
Wisdom.
Understanding. Eleleth means understanding. That's the angel that came to the daughter. See, this story is multi-generational in this myth. In the first case, it's Eve. She has come. She's something. And what has she said to them that pisses them off the most? What existed before you? This is the confrontation that the demiurge in the Gnostic myth continually deals with. What was before you? But you see, this demiurge, this figure in the Gnostic myth says, there is nothing before me. There are no gods before me. But you know, he knows he's lying. In all these myths, he knows at some point that there is something more. That is always revealed at some point in these myths. And once again, this is not one myth. There are several textual sources, traditions, that deal with this, that tell the story in their own ways. There's something before you. And the voice that says that is a feminine voice in these myths, a Sophianic voice. And what do they want to do to her? Rape her. Defile her. Subjugate her with their sexuality. Bisexuality. It's not like the Gnostics were against sexuality. I mean, in fact, in some Gnostic sects, it seems like sexuality was a sacred mystery. There seems to be that element that plays in, and we'll talk about that maybe in a minute. It was this type of sexuality. And then there's that thing. You know, when they're going to rape Eve, they put Adam asleep. And they say, you know, Adam's not one of us. He's not one of the rulers. He's actually our servant. We're going to lie to him. We're going to say that this thing, Eve, life, Sophia, this voice of awakening, is just a piece of him. What existed before you, gentlemen? I'm not just a piece of him. I'm not just a piece of his flesh. I was before. As I reflected on that, Of course, this has nothing to do with the Gnostic hermeneutic directly. Isn't that what we do in psychology, in some types of psychology, and actually in our neurophysiological knowledge of human functioning? These things, these voices, they're just you, just pieces of you. These images, they're just your thoughts, your mind, its juices squirting around. It's almost a defilement.
Was it the autonomy of ego that was attempting to subjugate her?
You see, that's a conceptual term. Was it the autonomy of the ego? The story doesn't say ego, and it doesn't use that concept. So we're sort of left looking at the experience, maybe reaching into our own experience, and maybe not even using a denotative terminology, and saying, what the hell is going on? What's our experience of this? But you know, you got to talk, you got to use words. Ego's one. Is this the ego afraid of being overpowered by something other than ego? If you want to use that terminology, perhaps. Except this ego is not just an ego, it's a power. It's a force in life. Is there perhaps a force in life itself, as experienced, as culturally experienced, as generally experienced by human beings, that wants to deny this voice, this reality, which is, as a matter of fact, what did you call it?
I also wanted to say the words that were used was truth and Eve was awakening Adam who he truly was.
Who he truly was.
And I think maybe that might be the threat, is that they're getting too close to the truth, too close to their own inner reality and who they truly are. And this is the threat to the... To the powers.
Yeah. To the authorities. The authorities. That's a good one. That's exactly what the word archon means, is the authorities. The authorities. Now, I talked about gnosis being generally a heresy. Well, to have a heresy, you have to have an orthodoxy, right? I mean, you can't be a heresy without an orthodoxy. And this is really the issue of the precept-concept thing, of breaking conceptual things, of moving the intractable. The voice that we experience, that tells us about life, is actually a progressive thing in human history. And it keeps fracturing the structures that say, this is it, this is how it is. That we don't really know how it is. In fact, maybe it isn't always as it is. Maybe we are standing up, changing, learning what it is to be human. In this age, if I reflect, you know, this myth forward, if I live it a bit in my imagination, there are intractable things in this world that say, really, you know, there is no such thing as this voice that says, Adam, awake. It's all our neurophysiology. And the question she asks of them is, who existed before you? Who existed before you? And some people, including Jung, seemed to be of the inclination to sense there was something before that, before them, before me and before you. And that thing was telling a story. And that we were living a story in relationship to it. The story was moving. Now, this story I told, is that heresy to received tradition in the year 200? Hell yes. This story has turned the story of Adam and Eve, a God story, on its head. It's turned that God on his head. It's an evolution in human understanding of its relationship with its tradition, with its dead, and with the story of its gods. Now, of course, the Christ story in some ways turned some of the story around too, but it was integrated. You know, over time it was really integrated in as a continuation. There are voices like Marcion, and there are voices among the Gnostic community that said, you know, this New Testament thing, this Christ thing, this is not the same divine image as it existed in Jehovah, Yahweh. This is different. This is a different God. But of course, there is actually a conflictual element there. And in history, that was sort of eased over. But let me give you a different type of reflection. A different type of reflection that came to me as I was facing up against this myth. Different mode of thinking about it. You know, we've talked about the need to remember, to connect with the depths. And I was asked a question last night about chaos. Madness also dwells in the depths. complexes, nasty archons guard the doors, both in and out. Psychologically, there are powers, archonic rulers, authorities, minions of this demiurge, who defile the soul. And they hold some people in that defilement, in horrific slavery. So as a doctor, I do not work much with concepts like individuation and the self. What I deal with is psychosis. What I deal with is PTSD, drug addiction, rape, violence. I deal with the soul in the depths of defilement. Yeah, I speak about this Jung stuff in this clean, polite environment. But I spend my days in disorder. As a doctor, shoveling the shit life drops on human heads and hearts and guts. And I know something about it. And I suspect many of you do too. Many of you do too. It is life. We meet it. I recently read Dr. Donald Kalshed's new book, Trauma and the Soul. Do any of you know Kalshed? Have you read any of his work, some of you?
Yeah. Paul Brannigan.
He was here. How long ago was that? I didn't know that.
It's been a couple of years. He'll come again in October.
Ah, in this October?
Yeah.
Oh, wonderful. I recently read Dr. Kalshed's new book, Trauma and the Soul. It is a masterful work. It's extremely well thought. It's deeply felt. And it's based on years of experience working with shattered souls, shattering traumatic wounds of the soul. I suspect some of you work with people who deal with what is conceptually categorized as dissociative disorders. What is the supposed cause of dissociative disorders? Trauma. Trauma. What type of trauma? When in life?
Childhood early.
It seems that there's also a type of dissociative disorder that can happen with trauma later, or at any time, such as PTSD, as we call it. In my dad's day, it was called shell shock. And it still was through the 70s and the 80s. I'll tell you that I remember I was 17 years old, 18 years old, the first time I found out what PTSD was. My father was a general staff officer in the Army. And he had been through World War II. In Burma, in China. And of course, when you're an officer, you don't mingle with enlisted men socially. So that was not part of my, family. There were lines drawn between commanders and their troops. But when my dad retired, on the 4th of July, he would have a party for all the military families in the area. We were in a relatively small college town. And I remember that 4th of July, I was in ROTC, and there was a sergeant in the ROTC who was, it was a master sergeant, which is the highest degree, highest rank you can be of an NCO. And I thought this guy was like, the G.I. Joe. I mean, this guy was basically as tough as they get, in my opinion. And I knew he was a master sergeant, and I knew what that meant. And my dad had a great deal of respect for his NCOs. So we invited him over. I mean, everybody came. And it was the 4th of July. And this would have been 1969. And at dark, we had a barbecue, and the fireworks started going off. Our house was real close to the high school where they did the fireworks. And I remember watching Sergeant Williams melt. I remember watching him start to sweat and shake. And then he went and got his wife and they left. And I didn't know what had happened. I thought, I didn't know at all. And after people had left, I asked my dad, what happened to Sergeant Williams? And my father was an intelligence officer. He'd spent years in the Pentagon as the chief of intelligence for all of East Asia while the Vietnam War was starting. He had fought in Burma. He knew this land very well. He knew what happens. And I knew that. And my dad took me aside and said that Sergeant Williams had what was called shell shock. Shell shock. And he told me that Sergeant Williams had just returned from a year on a riverboat in the Mekong Delta. And that he suffered shell shock. For 20 years I've been working in a VA hospital. Almost 20 years. Part-time, not all the time. Half my time. And I've been dealing with PTSD. And there are stories I could tell, which I won't tell now. I mean, they go on for a long time, of people I know. People recently who have jumped out of second-story windows after gunfire has gone off on a television set and gone running in their pajamas through the streets and have been found in a fetal ball underneath a bush in a park in Orem by the police, crying and shaking, thinking that they were in the midst of battle. They were seeing it. They were not seeing wives. They were not seeing television sets. They were seeing an imaginal world. And that imaginal world was tearing them apart. Conversion reactions. There's a patient I saw just a couple of months ago that really astonished me. It's pretty unusual that I see things that I haven't seen before at this point. I'm always interested in human experience. There was a woman who came in. She carried the diagnosis of PTSD. She came to the emergency room because she was blind. She had suddenly lost her vision entirely. It so happens that she came in just before I got to work. The doctor that was there before me had seen her. Sharp young doctor. And he told me the case. He told me what he was doing, that the woman had come in with sudden blindness, his exam. And he had called the neurologist to come in and get involved. He had ordered, you know, the CT scans and things like that. And I asked him, okay, he told me the story. I said, okay, what do you think's going on? Because I'm going to take over now. I'm going to be there for the rest of the night taking care of this patient. What's your opinion? And he said, it's a conversion reaction. A conversion reaction. What used to be called hysterical blindness, okay? So, I went in and saw the patient. And it so happens that she also had a history of having up to 12 seizures a day. Except the seizures were not seizures. They were what used to be called pseudo-seizures, false seizures, hysterical seizures. Nowadays, neurologists don't say that anymore. They talk about non-epileptiform seizures, which means people are shaking, but there's no shaking in the neural signals of the brain. It's something else is going on. Okay? And I saw the woman, and she was very convincing that she only had light-dark sensation. That was it. And I've taken care of conversion reactions, and even blindness is an unusual one. I mean, it really is. I don't see it, you know, a few times, and usually it's much more obvious, and it resolves pretty quickly, and people are really hysterical, hyperventilating, that sort of stuff. She wasn't. It was confusing to me. So, I called in the young neurology resident. The resident went and saw her. This is like 2 a.m. now, right? This is an all-night process. He sees her. He comes out of the room and says, you know, this is bullshit. You know, she's a head trip. This is, you know, hysterical. It's a conversion reaction. And of course, now we're getting the MRI scan. You know, we keep going through these gradations of study, trying to make sure that what you think is going on is what's going on. But there's a problem. There's a problem. This lady also has a problem. She has a connective tissue disease, a rather rare connective tissue disease, which can cause strange inflammation, including inflammation of the brain. So there might be a physiological cause underlying the conversion reaction. That it might not be. It might really be real. Well, anyway, so the young resident comes out, and this is a perfect teaching opportunity. We're waiting for the MRI scan to be done. It's the middle of the night. He's not going to go home. So he sits there, and I tell him a story. I asked him if he'd ever heard of Dr. Charcot, Auguste Martin Charcot, the father of neurology, who was interested actually in what was then called hysterical abnormalities. Abnormalities of human function which were not duplicated by any known neuroanatomical pathway, because Charcot was a great neuroanatomist. There are, I think, over 15 different things in medicine still named after eponyms after Dr. Charcot. And he didn't know a damn thing about Charcot. So I sat there and told him about hypnosis, about how they would hypnotize people to cause them to have, you know, these things that looked like diseases people were presenting with. Diseases that could not be traced to neuroanatomical pathways. And what he was calling this conversion reaction in this lady might be that. But the thing is, he didn't want to admit her. Because it was a head trip, right? This wasn't neurology. This wasn't medicine. This was a psychological problem. So at 3 in the morning, what does he want me to do, young sir? You want me to drag her out to the corner and leave her on the street, unable to see, to freeze? To wander around in front of traffic, blind? Or do you think we ought to admit her? Well, I can't admit her. This is a head trip. Didn't I just tell you, young sir, about one Dr. Charcot who was the father of your specialty? No, 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 this isn't neurology.
How many years ago is that?
It was in the 1880s.
No.
This story?
No, yeah. Like how, you said that was a resident.
Yeah.
Was that a resident recently?
Yeah, that was this happened it happened at the end of December. This year.
I just thought we were
kind of
getting past that.
Are you kidding? We're just getting started. We're just getting started on that stuff. This isn't medicine. This isn't medicine. The story is...
It isn't neurology.
It's
not neurology.
It's not neurology because it's not anatomically definable.
If I like anatomical better because I think there's no reason to think it's not physiological.
The point is there is a brain state connected with this...
Yeah.
Situation, isn't there? Is the brain state the cause, or is the other thing the cause of the brain state? And if there is another thing, what the hell is the other thing? Okay, I'll tell you that I got the lady admitted, that every test you can imagine was done over the next 3 days. Everything. I had the ophthalmologist in that night looking in her eyes, looking for swelling of the optic nerve, everything. And every test came back negative. In 2 days, she said she felt like she could see better, and they sent her home with no more questions asked. A dissociative state? Is that what that was? What was going on? Because I really was convinced that she did not think she could see. She could not see. She could not see in my exams. But there were things in her exam that did not fit. There are these little secret tests that I can't tell you that we have to tell if people are faking it. Because there are some things that you don't do that are not, you know, they're not bilaterally discriminated. There are certain sensations and types of things that are not bilaterally discriminated by brain lesions. And people who are hysterical don't know that. And that's why I can't tell you, because you might be hysterical and go to the ER and try to cheat. These are secrets. But there are things, there are secret things we do to tell if people are cheating. And when people are in this state, they tend to lateralize in ways that actually physiology does not.
What has happened in her life?
Huh?
What has happened in her life?
Do you think anyone asked?
I can't.
Well, how come there wasn't a psychiatrist?
Doctors? They're going to ask, what's happened in your life?
He's out to
Oh, 12.
This was at the VA.
This was at the VA.
Oh, this was at the VA. I had everything. I had everything, and the psychiatrist too. And you know, the psychiatrist. What did they, you know? What they say? Or this? I can't admit a blind patient to the my psych ward. She's going to stumble and fall down. I'll be liable. Honest to God, that I deal with that all the time. That sort of stuff. This patient is not stable for the psychiatry ward, and the doctor's telling me this patient is not medically ill enough for the medical ward. That is where we are.
Yeah.
That's where we are in this world. And I deal with that. Believe me, I could keep going with these cases for a long time, but I won't. I won't now. There's something else, though. There's something else. There is a thing called dissociative disorder that where people really do have something happen to them. And I we've talked about early life trauma as a cause of dissociative disorders. But there are these things that happen later, war things that cause dissociative states. They cause people to flee the outer reality. Like Eve up in the tree. Like Noreia, when she's going to be raped, she calls out and all of a sudden she's with the angel. Eve is with the tree of life. The rape takes place in this story. The rape takes place. It's just Eve has departed this body. She has dissociated herself from the Eve, the fleshly Eve who's being raped, and gone in to the tree of life. That's the myth. Is there a story there? Is there a reflection of things that actually happen? I've had, over the years, because I guess of my interests or whatever, I've met several people who deal with dissociative disorder. They have visions. They have visions. And somehow I end up talking to them. You know, I've been talking here in these prior sessions with a certain voice about Jung and psychology, a certain hermeneutic voice. And oh yes, I've said, you know, listen to the soul. Follow the yellow brick road to the land of Oz. And find the wizard. Find yourself. Do active imagination. Meet your fantasy world. Fantasy world. Listen to the voices. Individuate. But let's cut the bullshit. Cut the bullshit. The imaginative function may offer some individuals a healing, a renewal, or rebirth of wholeness. But it can also drive us crazy. It can overwhelm us. It can lead us into the jaws of psychosis. And I've watched this happen. And the result is psychic chaos. Some people cannot escape it. The inner world can fall away into the depths of chaos. And the people I meet most frequently just want out of the land of Oz. A witch wants them dead. Winged monkey-like demons are flying out of the night, trying to carry them away en toto. They come to the ER, or are dragged to the door of the magic cave, when death by suicide seemingly looms as the only release from bondage. And they are afraid. They're afraid of life. They're afraid of the chaos inside. They are afraid of these things that are holding them and that want them dead. It happens every day and every night repeatedly in my job, again and again. This inner world, as I mentioned last night, is not all bright, shining lights. There is chaos, complexity, multitude in the imaginal realm that we can meet. And Jung knew that chaos. He saw it on that night of January 18th of 1914. He had seen patients lost in psychosis. And that night he saw it himself. It was the night when all the walls fell down, all the dams broke, and Jung faced into the chaos, the abyss, its jaws opened before him. But he held his ground. He shuddered before it, and it did not fall into it. So I mentioned on the 100th anniversary of that night, I again read his account in January. I shared with you a prelude of that section in Liber Novus last night. I know people who have fallen into those depths. I see the archons raping souls held in those depths. And I'm almost helpless before it. My brand of medicine offers very little to cure such ills, such suffering. It seems that to hold one's ground before it, there must be ground. Jung said this was the fact of the grounding that held him before the fact of chaos. The ground was his relationship with life, with family, with his patients, with his work. He could face the dark, but there had to be a light of day. There had to be some solid ground. For some people, there is little light of day, or none. There is no solid ground. The chaos of the imaginal world, the inner world, the psychic world invades them. It is not willingly bidden. It comes unbidden and repeatedly. And I'm not speaking only of clinical psychosis here. Some individuals have great permeability to the imaginal. I meet more women than men who know this experience, but that's just my life experience, and I can't make general statements from that. It's just what I've met. So is it trauma that disposes them to it? And how much trauma is required? How much pain in the somatic realm of life is needed to evoke this dissociative escape into the tree of life? What is the defilement, the threat? Could life, just as it is by nature, be enough? Just life, as it is. What about the 3-year-old child with no traumatic history, who spends all night crying out in dream? All night. Every night. Seemingly in distress. What about the human being who has that as their experience every night of their life? And I know such people. And the dreams become the fears of day. Those are human experiences. There is a force, a nasty force, that keeps its claws in people and holds them in that realm. And it's hard to break loose. By what grace does the human soul hear the voice that says, "Awake, live"? It does sometimes happen. We hope, we listen, we offer what we can. Sometimes all one can do is look into another human's eyes and try to make human contact, soul to soul. Try to communicate that inner voice of awake. See something more present. Hear a voice of life. I have one person who's written me many letters who suffers from dissociative disorder, and what she's, and she's read the Red Book, and it's been very meaningful to her. In fact, she's a brilliant woman, brilliant, has integrated a great deal of this Jungian material. But her complaint is, it's not that I don't know what's going on. It's not that I can't get into this realm. I understand this very well, and believe me, she does. I mean, really, she is brilliant. The problem is, I can't control it. I can't get out of it. Ground. And this is where Jung, but Sonu and Hillman talked about the guardrail, the safety rail, the conceptual rail. Also, I've talked about logos, about the mind power, the ordering power of logos. It seems that when you're caught in that realm, having a guide rail, a guard rail, some rail, even a conceptual realm to help bring order is useful. Something has to bring you out of the chaos. And maybe that is the therapeutic value of a conceptual system for some people. You see, for some people, it's the trap. They can't get out of it. For other people, they're trapped in the chaos. They need something other. We both, in a way, need other things. One needs more image. The other one needs a hell of a lot less image and a little more order, ground. It goes both ways. It's not just image. It's not just logos. There has to be constructive relationship and contact between the two. So you asked me last night, you know, I talked about this image of this picture of Jung and the shining light, this bright star. And then I talked about the chaos. What's the difference? What's the difference? Jung met that chaos. And yet somehow, the experience of meeting the chaos, he felt was a necessary part of his development. What's the difference?
Just to respond to that a little bit, I think it does have to do with losing something of your own inner, I don't know, your own inner identity, maybe would be a word, that you lose some of that. I was telling Naomi yesterday that I learned this wonderful thing about Abraham from a Jewish friend, and when God called Abraham to leave his father and his country and go forward, that word to go forward, lek lekeh, could be interpreted go forward towards yourself. And again, bringing a Christian context into it, we see Jesus is always projected on, but he never gives way to either a positive or a negative projection. He always stays kind of in a centered relationship that never kind of breaks or fragments. And somehow through that whole passion, he maintains that. And I think that the trauma and the dissociation and all of that, I think it has to do with we buy it, or even the narcissist, you know, when we connect with a narcissist and they psychologically fragment us, mm-hmm. because we're buying onto their image of who we are. But when we release or relinquish our own inner identity, I think that's what causes the dissociation. We don't have any more grounding at that point. And as a child, that would be more prominent because they never did develop it in the first place. Mm-hmm. But then extreme trauma to someone, psychological, and usually the physical, if it's traumatic to that extent, has a psychological component, I think. And it's that kind of thing that just, it does something to your own sense of who you are, because the experience or the message that you're receiving is just compromising that.
I'm sorry to switch persons here. Eric Fromm uses the term a lot, character development. Character construction, which is a personal and individual developmental endeavor that becomes a kind of concretance, and which becomes our personal ground for interfacing with very challenging negative events. And I can see, I mean, in this discussion, from that point of view, how that would be a real importance to engaging trauma and coming back from it. But the less, I think, that we have, then the more difficult it would be for us really to deal with this desecration that we have experienced.
You know, I in my own experience with people who come in with real PTSD symptoms, enough to make a diagnosis by criteria, a large number of those people never saw combat. They were around it. They were near it. But they were not in it. They did not get blown up. They did not see their buddy blowing up. Although, believe me, I see a lot of people who are in that circumstance as well.
Well, I'm kind of thinking of several things. If you're talking about what used to be called multiple, if you're talking about what's now called dissociative identity disorder, one of the criteria is usually an early childhood with insufficient attachment. So when you were talking about there needs to be a ground to not fall into the chaos, the ground wasn't there.
There was no ground,
ever. There was
ever.
No ground. Mm. But what's also kind of interesting, I've perhaps worked with one person who could have been diagnosed that way in 40 years. But I have some colleagues who've worked with that more frequently. And one talked about how the kinds of spiritual experiences and psychic experiences people often have.
Who
would qualify, who are that dissociative. And so I think one can really make the distinction. PTSD may be a trauma that was beyond the person's capacity to integrate at that time. And so it's just there someplace, mm-hmm. in the psyche someplace,
yeah.
gets activated, and it's right there. But
the dissociative disorder, you're saying, then, is...
that, it's more profound.
Yes.
And I've worked with lots of people with dissociative disorders, where their psyche has been compromised by early trauma, and they've used a set of defenses to protect themselves that have walled off that trauma and have compromised who they are in their sense of themselves and their lives and their functioning.
And their function in all interaction, socially?
Not necessarily, but it can be fairly general. But they're not what we would consider to be dissociative identity disorder.
It's a spectrum, you see. You're saying that you can't draw the walls. Well, first of all, the PTSD thing, I think, is different. Because, you see, the people I've had who might be called dissociative, and these are concepts, they're lines. What I know is that diagnostic criteria are they're not strong boxes. We use them. But I know people, these experiences are very spiritual.
Absolutely.
Psychic.
Absolutely.
Intense.
Yes.
Mystical.
That somehow that boundary doesn't hold in the same way.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a spectrum that people go through. And, of course, because I've had this website and the Gnosis Archive, and I deal a lot with this visionary material, and I lecture about things like this, I get emails, and people want to talk about things. And I do that. And I've had some extraordinary letters. And I've entered some interesting conversations over the last 20 years with people I've never met. Stuff comes out. And then, of course, I've had friends and that have had some pretty extraordinary experiences. How does this all fit together? These are different elements of humans dealing with realities, actually visual realities, because in PTSD, some of these guys, when they're in the midst of it, and girls too, I should say, in the midst of it, they are seeing a battlefield. They are seeing things that are not there. They are hearing things that are not there. And then in dissociative disorders, people actually have visionary experiences, complete visionary experiences. And often they have mystical, pleasant. In fact, they don't want to leave them. You know, so in this deeper dissociative disorder, people don't want to come out of that place into this place. Except that place keeps getting bigger and bigger and deeper and deeper and deeper, and you can lose yourself entirely into the tree of life of it.
I know that there are going to be needing to be different treatments, and some of those medical, and I'll include psychotherapeutical as medical for this purpose. There are different types of treatments and different types of engagements and communications that are necessary. But I find that a lot of the problem here isn't that the thing isn't there. It's that we have very strict distinctions between reality and imagination, or the literal and the metaphorical. And time and time again, or over a long course of history, those have been shown to be conceptually suspect opposites and not really able to be separated out. Right? Derrida says it's metaphors all the way down. Right? The imagination is not unreal. To me, if a person reacts to a thought that there's fire in the room by running out of the room, that's real. If they sit in the room and they say there's fire in the room, but they don't act like there's fire in the room, then I think, well, that's something a little different, but it's still, I can't quite say it's unreal. It seems like it's more different than not there.
The problem is the person who sees the fire, there is no fire, and they're still running. And they won't stop running.
And they what?
Won't stop running.
Right. No, that's why I said I think that there's different effects from it, right?
Of course.
Treatments that are needed, communications. I'm not trying to say that the dissociative should be ignored in the dissociation, but I don't think it's a good idea to say it's not real. I don't think it's a good idea to treat the blind woman as not blind. I think that that's a terrible a malpractice.
She got treated like she was blind, believe me, and don't know, did a damn bit of good, but she felt better.
I was just going to say what you were talking about and what Claire was talking about sounds to me like what some people would call a good LSD trip. And I know people who use this regularly and skillfully to work their way through something that in their conscious mind they can't. I've been too scared to try it for myself, but I'm so curious.
But those people take drugs, like they take drugs to bring it on. That seems a little different than it coming from.
Is it?
Well, it's different in the sense that there's a voluntariness. There can be a voluntary to the invocation, if not once you're there.
Well, at some level,
there's a difference between voluntary
and
involuntary.
At some level, is if you go far enough in, is it voluntary to allow this other reality to emerge?
You know, there's a metaphor that Jung used in his discussions with Anil Yaffe of the Red Book. He said it was like a mescaline experiment. Mm-hmm. Except there was no mescaline involved. I don't think Jung ever took a hallucinogen, but he's certainly aware of them. Right. He's certainly aware of them. And I wouldn't be surprised if he saw or was around other people who were doing it. Because he was a doctor. He was an extremely curious guy. I mean, the guy was obviously into self-experimentation. And he did talk about such things in later life.
Well, and he hung out with Native American shamans in San Fe, didn't he?
No. Well, he had one visit with, you know, one in Taos in 1925. He was in Taos, and he had one long interview with a Indian chief, so not really, didn't hang out. He was there one for a few days. Anyway, he was interested in that stuff. Ruth.
So I had a client come in. He was in the midst of a difficult divorce. And he said something, I think it's something he had heard and he repeated, but he said, I felt like I was just existing on the edge of chaos. And then I realized chaos didn't have an edge.
That's great.
Chaos didn't have an edge. Now, you know, Jung in the Red Book, that's what he said is, you know, chaos is not singular. If it was singular, it wouldn't be chaos. Sort of the same thing. Then it'd just be one thing. It's everything. It is really everything. Well, look.
The other thing I wanted to mention, and Naomi, you may know a whole lot more about this, but so there was, and there still is, a process that people sometimes use to get into material and into other realms, called breath work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, so that's sure. A whole other process.
Yeah. Yeah, Stanislav Grof, you know, has been forwarding that. And of course, Grof started with LSD research, but in Czechoslovakia back in the 60s. Probably would prefer to still be doing LSD, but you can't in America. I actually went to one of the breathwork seminars years ago, just to see what it was like. It was interesting. I probably would have got more out of taking LSD, but it was interesting. Look, there's this spectrum. And when I start talking about the imaginal realm as this, I don't know, the Land of Oz, you have to step back a little bit, okay? The Land of Oz was not a friendly place. It isn't necessarily a friendly place. You can get lost in Oz, and there are things that will eat you, and they will keep you there. There are wicked witches. And you know what? There's also a nice one. There is a nice one, too. So what was this thing that Jung was doing? I mean, look, he had met the psychosis. He had met the mental illness in its depths. He worked in a psychiatric hospital mainly dedicated to taking care of psychotic individuals, not neurotics. The Berkholzli in Zurich, famous in Europe at that time. He was aware of the depths in human experience, the images. And he was, allowing that realm to come into relationship with the daylight realm, with the awake realm. He wasn't hiding from it anymore. That text I read you last night, there are walls that separate us. We think we have our quiet, secure place. Put your ear to the wall and listen to the rush of the voices of the dead. And then he said, and then the night came. The walls broke. All the dams let loose. He saw it. It was extremely important for him to go there, to understand these things. And he found bright things there, too. But he brought those things back into relationship with life. This life. He didn't stay in that realm or fall into it, although at one point he knew it was a risk. It is a risk for some people. This is something that Hillman talked about, I think, in his conversations with Sonu. He said there was always this talk when people were doing these active imagination things at the Jung Institute in the 50s of a latent psychosis. People were fearful of a latent psychosis. And Hillman says, well, what the hell is that? Well, Hillman had his feet on the ground a bit. There are people who start getting into this imaginal stuff and the ground opens right up. They can keep on going. The first, and I've been working through some of these things with somebody I knew quite well for many years, started going through he was in a period of deep change in his life, and things were coming at him. He was a very creative person, a writer, an artist, and things just broke all loose. And he wanted to sit down and talk about it. And he was doing drawings and art and painting things and writing things and dreams. And as we talked and talked over a period of weeks, it was clear to me this guy was about to lose all contact with reality. It is frightening. He's a brilliant man, and he was really on the edge of just falling away into this creative stream. And it was like, how the hell do we get out of this? How do we stop this? It isn't he needs more. This man needs, at this moment, less. That can happen as we engage the creative world.
Ayahuasca is called the death vine.
Ayahuasca, yes.
Yeah. And many Americans, many Westerners go into the jungle and under controlled conditions and experiment with that. And they report a lot of the same kinds of things that you've been talking about.
If it's there, if we can experience it, if experience relates to brain state, because every experience we have to say, well, there's a brain state. There may not only be one with any type of experience, but is any experience always the same? Our brain state's always changing. Well, anyway, if there's a brain state that can be associated with having a state of vision, one assumes that there are neurochemical pathways, things happening that allow it. And is it possible that an exterior substance could open such things to us? Well, of course it is. And indeed, if substances can open those pathways, the pathways must exist. So maybe they can be opened without the substance. You see, it goes both ways. It turns equally around. The differences are, I think, and this is my own critique of hallucinogens, is that a lot of people approach the whole thing like a party. I mean, it's a party drug. MDMA, ecstasy, was being used in California in therapeutic circles for people who had suffered really deep blocking traumas in life. And often, and I know therapists in some years ago who were working with MDMA with patients and having very important results because they were able to, especially emotional blockage, they were able to open to amazing contact with emotions. And it didn't go away when the drug ended. They were able to stay with that for weeks of therapy and work through things that otherwise they never could have got to. But if it becomes the drug for the rave, you see, it's a whole different motive. It's a whole different approach.
Just to sort of validate stories for a couple out of personal experience, and I can tell you from personal experience that I have witnessed LSD literally take people down, because what it does is shift the consciousness. And so this speaks to the very nature of consciousness for anyone that is ever interested. But for those of us that have spun up a story, a container inside of ourselves that is insulating us from some of the horrors of our own death, LSD can shift the lid on that container, and those demons come up. And when you are called upon to be the St. George to the dragon you're not prepared to see, it's not a game. As I don't need to tell you people about this part of it, because you go into institutionalization. One of those people successfully returned a year later, is now an MD. The other one is 25 years later, still institutionalized. So that is
two
personal stories, if you will.
Latent psychosis. There you have it, you see. That's the talk. Is this world is real, and we confront it. It's maintaining the balance. Maintaining the balance. Some people are too far to one side. Some people, and I think our culture generally, is a bit too far to the logos, reasonable side, denying the darks. It's not like we want to jump into it. And that's maybe, somebody mentioned the 60s earlier, about how the 60s changed. You're really just jumping into it. And okay, that was creative. It was a creative move in our culture. But you couldn't stay there. The chaos. It's like Artie Lang and his insane asylum. You know, bringing all the chaos together, and what happens is the place gets torn apart. All the windows are broken. I just want to finish a little bit with Dr. Kalshid. Throughout his book, Trauma and the Soul, Kalshid uses clinical cases, human stories, along with myths as mirrors reflecting our struggle with flesh and spirit, the two facts of life that hold us enthralled. Early in the book, Kalshid offers an overview of his way of understanding. He describes it as a, quote, kind of Gnostic fantasy of the soul's development in human life, unquote. This is how he summarizes his vision, what he calls his own Gnostic fantasy. And I quote, "It seems that the process of becoming the self, you were intended to be, involves the materialization of something spiritual. Some seed of true selfhood needs to make a perilous journey through very dangerous territory. From the world of eternity to the world of time. From spirit to matter. From divine to human. In order to become a human soul. Along the way, it will face many trials and suffer great disappointment, and it may never be able to make a full commitment to this hopeful journey if it suffers into reality too greatly. It may even be forced to split itself in two, sending part of itself back into the imperishable world from which it came, to make sure the soul is not annihilated. Sometimes it will be able to return from this dissociation and enter life once again. Along the way, glimpses of the light, of its origins, and its true companion may support it in its suffering. And if, through all the brokenness of the human condition, it finds enough of those sunny days when life seems possible, enough of those resonant images, empathic self-objects, and optimal frustrations that make love worth the sacrifice of omnipotence, if it makes it to these shores with some of its original divinity intact and not as a false self, then in the language of T.S. Eliot, it will have arrived where it started and know the place for the first time. Dr. Kalshed, there is a brief modern Gnostic myth about psychology, written by a psychologist who spent 40 years working with immense suffering. And it is, just as he proclaimed it to be, a Gnostic fantasy, true to Gnostic tradition. It is a fantasy that visions the journey through life in both mythical, archetypal, and in modern clinical vocabulary. It is a psychological approach to both myth and mythopoiesis, the myth-making function in us. Dr. Kalshed has brought the experience of image and mythopoiesis into his clinical art. His writing is balanced by experience, his perceptions of a healing process he has witnessed. The angel of understanding said to Noria, "These authorities cannot defile you. These authorities cannot defile you. For your home is with incorruptibility, where the virgin spirit dwells, who is superior to the authorities of chaos and of their world." James Hillman, in his conversations with Sonu Shambhasani, stated that we need a new way of talking about psychology, a language that is not denotative, conceptual. Is Donald Kalshed showing us an example of such language with that myth? I'll leave you with that question. Let's take a break.